Good evening, podcast devotees. My name is Michael Cohan, and I've been recording this podcast for my teacher, Yogeshwar Das, for the last 5 years. We would like to give a special thanks to those devotees from Salt Lake City and California who have been inspired by this podcast and have been a part of our Sunset Gita community that we are not aware of. We would love to hear from you, especially those California devotees that listen to this podcast. You know who you are, and everybody else around the world. Please join us on our Facebook page at Gita Wisdom. You can search it. Become a group member. Send us a message. Tell us what you want from this class. We would love to add your input to our program so we can better service you and provide you with needs. Once again, thank you for being part of our community. We were surprised to find the thousands of people on iTunes listening to this podcast around the world. And we'd love to continue to grow this podcast, and we require your input to make it better. So thank you very much for joining. And we are about to start the program, so I'm going to pass it over to Yogeshwar, who is about to speak.
Put that. Yours is over here now. Okay. All right. All right. Good evening, everyone. Good to see you all again. We have a very a special guest with us this evening, and I thought I would just start by reading a brief biography of our guest, just to give you an idea of who we have here. I'm going to paraphrase some of this. As a young woman, from ages 9 to 15, Adele Green performed in recital halls and on radio as a pianist and actor. She attended the Juilliard School of Music and the New School for Social Research. She married and gave birth to me. She acted off-Broadway and in summer stock and rose from secretary to senior vice president at Reuter and Finn, a public relations firm. Following a six-month national search by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Gigi, as she is now known to friends and fans, was chosen the top communications executive at CPB, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, becoming the first female officer in the history of public broadcasting. She then founded Green and Associates, a management consulting firm, and served as the executive director of the American Craft Council, and later as executive director of the American Friends of the British Museum, providing leadership coaching to executives in fields ranging from industry to the arts. She is an avid devotee of theater, symphonic music, and jazz, a zealous reader and an addict of Scrabble and crossword puzzles, and she wrote she writes books, small books. She wrote one for her granddaughter, my daughter Kara, on her sixth birthday, and then one for my son when he graduated college. And in the early 1980s, she wrote and published her memoir, which is called Sarah's Legacy. We'll talk a little bit about that this evening. And she's currently at work on a new book called Musings, which is a collection of essays. Adele Green is a New Yorker, the eldest of three children born to Austrian Jewish immigrants. And
read that next thing.
Do I got it?
Yes.
All right. My most significant contribution to society, she says, is Joshua. All right, whatever. I'm particularly honored to have my mom here this evening because we talk a lot about living an examined life here, living a life fully and what it means to live a life fully. And this is someone who has lived her life fully. May I say that this year you are turning 89?
I will be 89 in September.
89 in September. And I also want to say that it has been a privilege to be your son. So would you please join me in welcoming Gigi to our gathering? Just before we get started, I'm put in mind of a similar introduction I once made for you at the United Nations. It was on the occasion of the premiere screening of a film that I was honored to produce celebrating the 50th anniversary of the UN. And the head of protocol, when introducing the program, knew that my mother was there in the audience and invited me to introduce my mother to the delegates and attendees at this screening. So I remember thinking to myself, okay, let me get this straight. I'm introducing my mother in the United Nations. Okay, granted it was the dining room of the United Nations, but still it was the United Nations. And I remember thinking at that moment, I have achieved now what it is that I have been put on this earth to achieve, and I can die. In a strange way, it gives me even greater satisfaction to welcome you here at Jiva Mukti. First of all, the food's better. That's one.
Well, but the crowd's nicer.
And the crowd is nicer. That's right.
Friendlier.
I'm privileged to know these people, to have them as my friends. You will find their questions insightful. And so I'm really, really glad we're able to do this. We talked about how to kind of get this whole ball rolling, mm-hmm. didn't we? And what we said was it might be a nice idea. And by the way, there's going to be lots of questions for time for Q&A here. You're going to be able to say whatever, ask whatever you want. It's difficult, isn't it, for these youngins here, you know, these young folk growing up in a very different kind of world from the one that we knew when we were growing up.
You can't say we because you and I don't come out of the same world.
Well, you go back earlier than I do, I'll grant you that. But what would you say are some of the most significant or important differences between the world that you recall as a young woman and the world that we're in today?
I was born in 1925. That was the year that Charles Lindbergh crossed the ocean, first solo aeronaut to make such an achievement. And we thought that was a major accomplishment. We had no idea there were going to be these jumbo jets and overnight flights to here or there and all over the world. So transportation was one major change. But when I first got into the business world, we had radio. We had just started having television. There wasn't even a fax machine. So communication was conducted either by letter or telephone or in person. Or if you're really in a hurry, you could find a messenger service who would take your document to its destination. So technology is one rather dramatic difference between then and now. And because I'm female and highly informed of what's going on with our population these days, somebody mentioned Mad Men earlier. It is a reflection of what was taking place in the workplace at that time. Women had no particular defenders. Nobody even considered that our lives were different than men's lives. If men were being rude to us or sexually offensive, there was nobody to stand up for us. And it was sometimes difficult if you needed your job and one of your bosses was coming on to you and you didn't know how to handle that, a sense of humor came in handy. I remember one of my bosses once, I'll use the word, accosting me in an elevator, and he had never spoken to me from the time that I had first come to the company, and he slipped his arm around my waist, which I thought was a little bit aggressive, and he said, "Are you enjoying your time with our company?" And as his hand was starting to slide upward, I said, "Oh, Mr. Gaynor, if you weren't married, I would make such a play for you," at which point the elevator's door opened and I escaped to my desk. And of course, he never spoke to me again, but I wondered whether I'd be fired, and I wondered if I'd ever get a raise, because these things were very much connected. There's an episode that I remember. When I, Joshua mentioned that I started at Reuter and Finn as a secretary, and I sort of worked my way up. I became an assistant, and then I became an account executive, and then I became a vice president, and ultimately left there as a senior vice president. When I became an account executive, Reuter and Finn, which was a public relations firm and one of the best in the world, had many, many important clients. There were not too many female account executives. The way the public relations business was conducted in those days is that we acquired clients, and they could be anything from the fashion business to industry to the financial field or the arts. It didn't matter. There were clients of all variety. And the job of the public relations person was to establish a strategy for that company to proceed to communicate into the world, its broader audiences. And one of the ways that we did that was through publicity. In those days, because we didn't have the kind of technology that we have right now, all of the contact with editors was through a press release or in a telephone conversation, or very often, if you had an important client, an important story, you would take an editor to lunch. That sometimes became embarrassing for male writers. Journalists felt that women were not supposed to pay for them. And clients never let me pay for them. So I had to find devices to get around that so I could pick up the check without embarrassing anybody. And I remember I particularly liked the Plaza Hotel, which in those days was very different from it is now. And there was a wonderful maitre d' there, and I went up to him one day and I said, "Henry, I will be bringing various clients to the restaurant, and I don't want them paying the check. So when I come in, I will give you my credit card. Will you please add all the appropriate gratuities and something for yourself? I'll sign it now, or I can sign it at a future time, but under no circumstances bring the check to the table." He said, "Yes, indeed, Mrs. Green." And so I remember the first time that I took a client to lunch and he asked the waiter for the check and the waiter said, "It's all been handled, sir." And he turned to me and he said, "Oh, very classy." So the point that I'm trying to make here is that when we have problems to solve, you have to find devices, you have to be creative about it, you have to find ways to get around these things. Which leads me to one of my favorite characteristics in people. If you're creative, I love you. And if you're resourceful and curious, I love you even more. And all of this presumes intelligence. The human mind. It's the one significant tool we have in our lives. I know that there are people who think that their good looks or their talents or the whatever. No, this is the thing that gets us through life. When you're stuck and you don't know where to go, this is what will help you out. Maybe it'll be your good looks, maybe it'll be your talent, but more likely this will get you out of trouble, and that's what you have to rely upon. And so I encourage you at all times, make the most of your brain, and don't ever, especially if you're female, don't go helpless. It's not necessary. You'll do yourself a favor if you use your brain as much as possible.
Well, so you're already getting an idea. This is a woman who was liberated before it was chic. And, you know, growing up with this was really quite an experience. I can't figure out when, I mean, apart from being mother and son, when did we become good friends? What made the difference? What happened that all of a sudden it was more than just a family relationship? Can you recall?
Yeah, your curiosity. You always asked really incisive questions, and because I took you seriously and never treated you like a child, we would have good talks, and those good talks.
Yeah, we did have good talks.
Yeah, so it was the talks that made for the friendship.
I don't know if I'm springing this on you, but when I thought about this, there was one moment that came to mind for me when I think you changed into somebody that I really wanted to be good friends with, this person. And maybe you'll remember what the circumstances were better than I do, but we were in a taxi and we were going somewhere. I don't know whether it must have been in the 80s at some point. And I remember you were very thoughtful, you know, just like, you know, what's on your mind? And you said, I wonder how much of myself I've had to sacrifice for the life I live. And I think that was the moment in my memory when I see you moving from the career-oriented, you know, high-powered woman executive into a different mindset, which was one of wanting to go inside and understand yourself more. Does that make any sense?
I don't remember the incident. And I did want to make one suggestion. I never went for a career. I never even thought of having a career. I needed a job because I was trying to support and raise him. And the only way I knew to do that was to have a job and get a regular salary. I had been in the theater and music before that. You can't count on that. It's irregular. You never know what the income will be. You don't know when you'll be working, when you won't be working. And you have crazy hours. And I wanted to provide, because his father and I were divorced, I wanted to provide some kind of normalcy in Joshua's life. And I thought a daytime job would permit me to be home with him at regular hours, be with him before he went off to nursery school or wherever. So that in the search for normalcy and income, I looked for a job. And because I didn't know how to do anything, I went to a typing school to learn to be a typist. And then I went to secretarial school to learn to do shorthand. And then I was able to look for a job that would permit me to be somebody's secretary. And so it went. Now, what do you give up in all of that? Sleep is what you give up, you know. And if he was ill and I had to try to find some way to take care of him when I was working a job and going to school afterwards and, you know, and taking him to school in the morning, going to work, picking him up from school, bringing him home, feeding him, going off to typing school or whatever it was, you know, it was a kind of a hectic schedule. And the one thing that gets sacrificed is sleep. So for a long time, I had circles down to here. But I knew what the objective was. The brain, know what the objective was. Stay focused. I'm not saying give up the exploration of other possibilities in your life. But you have to know what are the primary objectives in your life. It was easy for me. I had him, that was it. Nothing else mattered. He had to get educated. And the only way that I was going to do that was to find the money to pay for schooling. Along the way, I discovered that I liked working. I really, really liked working because it permitted me to be resourceful. If I was a volunteer for things that the boss wasn't necessarily looking for, that pleased him, but it also stimulated me. And it sometimes brought me to the attention of other people who were looking for somebody with different skills than the secretarial ones. So, you know, these things seem to feed each other. Back to the concept that I was never looking for a career, it came to me. Because in learning more about public relations from the secretarial, assistant, account executive perspective, suddenly I realized, you know, I'm pretty good at this. I like it. And why do I like it? Because it's problem solving. A client comes to you with a corporate dilemma. This is the problem we're having. And we can't seem to solve it ourselves. So we need somebody to come in and tell us what we need to do. Well, how do that? You do your investigative work. You become a corporate detective. You find out as much as you can about the company. Sometimes it takes 2 months, sometimes it takes 6 months. But you talk to people on the inside of the company, you talk to their competitors, you talk to the media. How is this company perceived in the environment that it operates in? And then you say, okay. So then you go back to the client who hired you and you say, so what did you say your problem was? And he'll tell you, and I say, okay. But there are people on the outside who think your problem is something else. And therefore, your perspective on what you have to do to fix your problems has to broaden. You have to take into account what other people also think.
Yeah, if I could just jump in for a second.
Yeah.
That speaks to me, because a lot of the discussions that we have here touch on the difference between reality and our perceptions of reality. And so often we look at something and we see what we want to see. We're not seeing what's actually going on because maybe we're afraid to see what's really going on. So we'll see something that makes it more palatable, more manageable, and it'll take a consultant or in the yoga culture, some internal work to shift that kind of vision. I recall that. I recall those client sessions where, you know, people would sometimes do a 180. But they thought they were coming in needing this, and after having that review session with you, it would be something totally different.
Yeah, any public relations professional worth her or his salt will come along and say, okay, let me just open your vision on what your company is. Because until you really understand what your problems are and why you're having them, you don't really know what your corporate image is. Now, this is as true of people as it is of corporations. Until you really understand your identity, until you really know who you are, strengths, weaknesses, things you can fix, things you'll never be able to fix, until you understand all of that, and you have to be ruthless in the assessment of it, then you can't go out and say, okay, this is how I present myself. This is who I am. And until you know who you are, you don't know who anybody else is. You may stab at it, but you really...
Does it sound like Bhagavad Gita to anybody else? See, this is why I love talking to her. Because she doesn't use Sanskrit. But the ideas end up being very, very parallel. You know, the idea of self-examination, whether you call that, you know, Savikalpa Samadhi, or, you know, a client session. You know, it's the same idea of stripping away the layers that have separated us from what's actually going on.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna jump to something here. What's all the cleaning of the drawers and closets all about? Well, you're always cleaning drawers and closets, and I'm sure there's a connection here somewhere. This is a standing joke with us, because my mom's apartment is about 3 by 5 inches big, and yet she finds things to clean and organize in it all the freaking time. You know? And I'll call and say, hey, what are you doing today? Oh, I got to do my closets. What more closets do you need? Yeah, we got to organize the toothpicks or something. So what is going on there when you're doing that? Cause, I mean, it's a beautiful study in space conservation. You know, you go into this place and it's like walking through a museum or whatever, a gallery. It's just beautiful. What's going on there?
The word refinement suddenly popped into my head. I'm very responsive to aesthetics. I can't make my way through clutter. Sometimes I see clutter and I can see what was intended by it. But if it's just clutter and it has no intent, it drives me crazy. And I immediately want to go in and fix it and put it in order. Mm-hmm. Now, for me, I'm not a collector. I'm a divester. I collect ideas. I collect experiences. I collect things I can carry with me at all times. But I don't collect things. So when I find an accumulation of things, for example, in a closet, my size has changed. I used to be a 6, then I was a 14, then I went to 10. I mean, you know, it changes. If I haven't worn it for 2 years, I'm never going to wear it. So if I go through my closet every 6 months or year, and I pull things out, and most of them are in pretty good shape, then I give them to people I love, whom I think they would work right with, or I give them to a thrift shop or something, but there's no need for it to take room up in my closet, because if I have fewer things in my closet, it's easier for me to decide what I want to wear. Well, these days I wear black pants. I've got about 8 pairs. I wear black pants and some kind of a top. I don't know. Because it makes life easier for me. I don't want to have to think about that.
It's difficult, though, isn't it? It's not an easy thing. Or maybe it's easier for you now, but have any of you tried to, like, clean up old stuff? Get rid of old stuff? It's not easy. We're attached to it, aren't we?
Yeah, especially papers.
I can't get rid of that. I mean, I've had it for 30 years, but I can't get rid of it now. Yeah. Maybe because I've had it for 30 years, I don't want to get rid of it, but I don't need it.
Well, if you had it for 30 years, there's probably a reason.
All right, 30 years maybe. You know, but a lot of stuff's just not necessary.
Well, papers. As I progress through my experiential working life, I had held on to things from every job thinking, well, this will be a good reference in case I get a blah, blah, blah. Well, then one day I discovered I'm never going to have a client of the kind that I used to have. So why do I need all of those papers? Well, some of them were there because they were letters of commendation, and they were recognition of things. And we all love this. And I just held on to them because I thought, well, look how wonderful I've been in my life. And then I thought, well, if you're so wonderful, why do you need a piece of paper to confirm it? So it was easier to get rid of the papers.
Okay. You know what I had a hard time getting rid of? I had a collection of love letters.
Oh, those are hard.
Yeah, and I was like, I really didn't want to let go, because it's getting rid of certain memories as well. You know, a very important time, a very exciting time. And somehow those letters embodied that part of my earlier life that I really didn't want to say goodbye to. And finally, I did. It was a very hard, hard thing to do.
But clarifying.
Well, yeah. It was an acceptance that life's moved on. You know, instead of desperately holding on to something in the past, just accepting that, no, that's over now, and moving on and being okay with it.
Yeah, but sometimes the things we're trying to hang on to no longer have real value for us. And if there was value in the something that the relationship was, its residual effects will stay with you. So that throwing the papers out, don't throw out the benefits of the relationship.
So can I get rid of my elementary school sweatshirt now?
No.
I kid you not. She had this thing, you know, this little sweatshirt this big. You know? It's like, look, here it is.
Well, know? I told you to send it to my brother.
I did. Let him get rid of it.
Okay. When my brother was fighting in the Korean War, he found this tiny little sweatshirt. He was about 3 at the time, and he sent it.
She kept it from the Korean War. She kept the sweatshirt.
And then finally, one day, I gave it to him. He said, "What am I going to do with it?" I said, "Give it to my brother." So my brother had it all. It went round robin, and it went right back to him. And it made him remember his Korean experiences.
Now, as long as we're talking about memories, let me ask you a question here. I have a copy of your memoir here, and I know you sold out the first printing very quickly. It's called Sarah's Legacy. Now, why did you call it Sarah's Legacy? Explain what that means.
Sarah was my mother. My mother was hell on wheels. She was brilliant. She was resourceful, and she was a killer. She was ruthless, she was cruel, she was hard, and she was memorable. And I hated her for the early part of my life. And I used to scream at her, "I hate you, I hope you die, I don't want you in my life anymore." She used to literally hit me, and there were times in the summer when we were wearing short sleeves or no sleeve clothes. I would wear long sleeves because I didn't want the welts to show. So she was a vigorous woman with a serious neurotic component. I went through many years of therapy and came to realize that my mother was that way not because she hated me, but because she had her own problems and she was carrying her own baggage around. And when I came to understand what those pieces of luggage were that she was marching with, I came to recognize that it was understandable that she was as frustrated as she was. Her manifestations were not to my liking, but I was able to forgive her.
What kind of baggage are we talking about? What made her that way?
My mother was born the eldest of 12 children, and she was a girl. Her father was an Orthodox Jew, and that was an absolute embarrassment for him. The idea that his first child should be a female was just odious. Not acceptable. And so he just ignored her. She was brilliant, she was funny, she was attractive, she was all kinds of things. Didn't matter. It didn't matter. And so he ignored her. And her attempt to become more and more and more and have it totally ignored became an ultimate frustration to her. In addition to everything else, she was a very emancipated woman. She spoke her mind. She was strong. She was resourceful. They lived in a part of Austria where pogroms would take place, and Jews were harassed and beaten, and their beards pulled, and their hair pulled out, and all kinds of things. And So her father, who was a scholar, a Talmudic scholar, buried himself in his work and his studies, and was a tyrant. He was an impressive man. I met him on some occasions because we went to Europe a couple of times. But females were of no value whatever. You didn't bother to educate them. You didn't train them to do anything but have children and feed the family. And so my mother's attempt at achieving some kind of recognition for her gifts, her talents, went unnoticed and ignored, and it was difficult for her. When she met my father, she 18, he 19, because she knew that her father would not consider my father good enough. He wasn't an ardent enough student, I guess. They eloped. They ran to the home of some cousins in Berlin and eloped and married. And then my father, through relatives, came to the United States, and a year later she followed. My mother's family were wealthy. My father's were not. My mother's family were in the textile business. Their name was Semel, S-E-M-E-L, and they established a textile plant here in New York, and they were down in the section, the downtown section, and there were a couple of buildings with a cornerstone of Semel on it, and they had the most beautiful quality textiles in the building, and my mother used to buy remnants from there. However, when my father first came here, the Semels gave him textiles, which he took out on a pushcart down to the Lower East Side, and that was how he made his living. When my mother came here, neither one of them could speak, read, or write English, which I think is very, very courageous to come to a country where, you know, I mean, if they didn't have the cousins, they would have been totally bereft. My mother insisted that every penny my father earned that wasn't needed to be put on the table go into a fund so that he could study English. She said, I had two dresses. I had the dress I wore and the dress I was laundering. And so he learned English, reading, writing, whatever, and he got a job as the first Jewish person in the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company in Newark, New Jersey. My mother never studied English. She picked it up. She spoke with an accent, which was very mortifying to me. Oh. And they moved on. They were intelligent, aggressive people who wanted movement. I was born when my father was working for the Met Insurance Company. Later in life, he became a diamond merchant. That's a whole other story. I won't even go into that. And so we became upper middle class in good time. And my mother, who had exquisite taste, and as I said before, was very resourceful, found all the people to give my sister and my brother and me our needs, the education we should have, the extra lessons we should have, the fine clothes that were made for us. I mean, it was ridiculous. I wish I had that wardrobe now. And she was a woman who knew how to do everything instinctually or through research. She found ways to do everything that she needed to do.
Would it be accurate to say that as difficult and as tough as she was, it sounds like you're also expressing appreciation for having picked up a lot, which is what led you to name your book Sarah's Legacy.
Yes, because
now, what is the legacy that you're talking about? Is it the toughness?
Toughness, intelligence, which I can't take credit for because I inherited it. Talents, resourcefulness, curiosity, interest in other people. My girlfriends used to love to come to our house. I couldn't understand it. They wanted to talk to my mother because she was so interesting. And I used to go out of the room. I thought, they're crazy. What? They're my friends. What is this all about? But she was a fascinating woman with a richness of creative thought and experiences they had never even heard about. So it was all of her gifts that she passed on to me. I had gone through therapy, so I wasn't a killer, so you came off okay. No bruises.
So far, so good.
But, she left me a lot of stuff.
So we're products of our upbringing and our environment and the influences earlier in life. And then something happens, if you're lucky, somewhere along the way, you find yourself, what would the word be? Capable, inspired, sufficiently curious to go to a deeper place? I mean, we know a lot of people. We talk about this a lot. We know people who have reached a very advanced age and they've never bothered trying to figure out who they are. They got stuck somewhere. They got stuck along the way, and that evolution of self-awareness atrophied. It got cut off. It wasn't nourished. What makes the difference?
I think there are two kinds of people in the world. There are the risk takers, and Sarah was one of them, and I'm one of them, and I think you're one of them, who are willing to go out on a limb and even make mistakes, because if you make mistakes, you say, whoops, I'm never doing that again, and you find another course. You learn from them. And then there are those who desperately require security because they're afraid if they make a mistake, there are consequences. Maybe they won't be liked. Maybe they'll be considered a failure. Maybe they'll consider themselves a failure. They won't fit in. That need to fit in is a killer. I don't think anybody in this room is going to qualify for that one, because you wouldn't be here if you were trying to fit in. This is an act of rebellion. Yay! You can't follow the trodden path. You have to find your own. You have to recognize your own gifts and pursue them. You have to pursue your own interests. You have to decide what in the world do you not know about that you have to find out about, and go for it.
Now I'm getting a better insight into how terrifying it must have been for you when you came to London and saw your 19-year-old son with a shaved head and robes, which must have struck you as the diametric opposite of doing, you know, your own thing. All of a sudden he's conforming to this thing, and who knows what this thing is that he's conforming.
I didn't think you were conforming.
No?
No.
Okay. We didn't like it. You want to know how important arranging is for... When she came over, she was very good. She played it very cool. Very cool. I remember we went for a walk out by the British Museum, you know, and I said, what do you think? You know, and she said, well, you know, you're not hurting other people. You're not hurting yourself. You know, you're a grown guy. You can make up your own mind, you know. And she immediately went out and got drunk.
I did not.
And yes, you did. And went into the pub and started arranging the ashtrays. No, come on, admit
no,
it.
That wasn't immediately after. That was after you got married.
Oh, well, all right, that was even worse. Okay. But that was, I think that was... I love when you tell that story. We don't know what we do to our parents. This was a very, very big thing.
Well, I had this image of what my son, whom I had worked so hard to educate, oh, God, I didn't buy a coat for 5 years. I mean, there were things that I didn't do. So
the
that
sacrifices
he could have,
I made for
he could
you.
Have private
and look
school
what you did.
And college and the Sorbonne and all that
stuff. This is how you retain me? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
So I went to the temple in London, and there he was, sitting on the floor, eating with his fingers, after all of the manners training.
Right out the window.
And then they went on a street kirtan in London. It was cold, it was rainy and snowy, and everybody was wearing these long underwear things with the robes hanging out and the coats on top of it and the loshes and... You know, he's playing...
I'm not sure the wardrobe's changed much.
No, it hasn't. And they're marching down the street, and I'm at the tail end of it trying to understand what is this all about. And the Brits are all lined up on the street watching these freaks go by. And I'm saying to myself, what does this all mean?
Very 60s, the whole scene.
I went back to my hotel and cried till my eyes were out to here. And... You know, I thought, well, he's old enough. He said to me, I'm doing what you told me to do. You told me that if I have any convictions, to follow them, even if you don't agree. I thought, the chickens come home to roost, fine. You know.
Yeah, but you really played it cool. I got to hand it to you. This was smooth. Oh, this was butter. I mean, the way she handled this was incredible. I remember it might have been the lowest point in my entire career as a devotee, the day we were having a Sankirtan chanting party going to Central Park. It was a warm summer day here in New York, maybe 1972, 73. Mm-hmm. And I came to see you first because my mom lives nearby Central Park. And you rearranged my dhoti because you wanted it to look nice. And I'm thinking, oh my God. My mom's still dressing me. No, but I really do appreciate the way you handled all of that. Obviously, it was very, I think it was very smart on your part to, as you said a moment ago, you know, you have to be prepared to make sometimes very risky choices in order to find your path. And if you're not one of those people who's willing to take risks, who's willing to step outside their comfort zone, then how do you find out who you are? I don't know if it's possible to find out who you are without taking some risks.
And those risks include hearing other people's opinions of you. And you may not like what you're hearing. And you may dramatically disagree with what you're hearing, but it's important to keep your ears open. If somebody has that perception of you, maybe it's that person's problem, maybe it's not yours, but you owe it to yourself to hear it and examine it.
Because maybe there's a grain of truth in it.
Maybe there's something there. Yeah.
That you can learn. I'm going to open this up. You guys are welcome to tell your own sob stories, ask questions, whatever it is. Akai?
Yeah. It's so nice to meet you. I was wondering if you ever met Srila Prabhupada. She ever met her?
Ever went through the...
Prabhupada. Spiritual teacher?
I did. I didn't like him. I think I told him so.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and what did he say?
He was a profound man. I think he's probably heard that before, had heard it before. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that he understood.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably a very complicated meeting because Joshua grew up essentially without a father, and I knew this man had become his father. And he had always been mine. So it was not just that I didn't like what this man was teaching him. I didn't like the competition. I couldn't admit it to myself at that time, but, you know.
There's something else as well, and I think you're right. Prabhupada didn't always impress everyone. I think sometimes because we're faithful students, we like to portray him as someone who was beloved by everyone. But you're right. What he represented was threatening to many people. Yeah. And of course, what they did not like was not him, but what his beliefs and teachings told people about themselves, mm-hmm. which is what they were responding to. But I think you're quite right. It was a very commanding presence in some ways. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Did the meeting happen in Paris or
London?
Paris?
London.
In London.
In London, yes.
Leela?
I was going to ask that same question.
Yeah. Oh.
Like, I wasn't sure about that. And then I was wondering if your opinions maybe changed from the time, I guess, Joshua started to become a devotee until now, and see how, you know, over the years it develops into or evolves into another thing than just this new lifestyle?
The first step in that direction was that, well, he's not hurting himself or anybody else. And I respect Joshua, and he really believes in this. So if I don't understand it, that's because I haven't studied it or looked into it far enough, but it's suiting him. So that has to be okay for me. In time, I came to realize that there were many benefits that he experienced as a result of his convictions. Yeah. There was somebody over here.
I've been coming to Joshua's lectures for, I think, over 2 years, and I always come because I think Josh is a wonderful public speaker, a wonderful teacher. He has amazing command of language, and he's able to teach me these abstract ideas using words that I can understand. And so I love being a student. You have another son who does the exact same thing. And when I read Fabric of the Cosmos, I was always blown away by Brian's teachings. And I've seen him speak at the World Science Festival and talk at Barnes & Noble once he did book signing. Do you have any stories that come to mind about Brian and Joshua's sibling rivalry or brotherly rivalry or anything funny about like Thanksgiving or something? I'm curious to know what it was like to have these two brains in the house.
No, let me set the record straight. Brian Green is not my son.
Oh, sorry.
No. Okay. And when Joshua's father and I divorced, 2 years later, he remarried. And
okay.
Brian is the product of that second marriage.
Ah,
and there was one day when Joshua, I was by this time living in Washington, Joshua called me and I said, "You sound funny, where are you?" He said, "I'm in the hospital visiting Dad. He's here for such and such and such and so." Oh, here comes Brian. And you know what? Brian just won a Rhodes Scholarship. And I said, "Put your father on the phone." And he put Alan on the phone. And I said, "You rat. All these years I've been taking credit for Joshua's intelligence, and then you do this to me?" So yeah, Brian came out of a very intelligent pair of parents. But
awesome.
I'm not one of them.
Oh, sure. Do you have any recollections of them as siblings?
They weren't very close. Alan went into his second marriage and made that his life. And so we became us. And Joshua would go off to see his father from time to time, but he was never really part of that family. He and Brian still see each other today.
Oh, yeah. We're close now. But in those days, I was living in the temple. And, you know, I would in Europe, so I would come back sometimes and see Brian. He does credit me with having made him a vegetarian. When he was very young, he asked me why I was a vegetarian. So I explained to him. He was chickens or turkeys or whatever, they're living beings, you know, they're alive ones. And that, now he's stricter than I am. It makes me look like a chump, he's so strict. But yeah, sure.
I appreciate very much your telling us that stories about your childhood and growing up and your relationship with your mother. I too had a very difficult relationship with my mother. She was extraordinarily challenging, and that very long history ended up with love between the two of us. I noticed some things in my life about her and her harshness that helped me to become who I was, because in a way it was kind of a tough love. You know, you can either go rebel against it or you can learn from it. But I also noticed some of the more spiritual things that helped me along the way. My relationship with God was very strong, even as a child. I was wondering, do you feel that there were any, besides the spiritual relationship with life itself, were there other spiritual influences in your life that helped you along your way as you went through your difficult moments in life?
Good question. I don't know if I'm spiritual. I know I'm not religious. I'm an agnostic. I listen to everybody. I don't know everything. And a lot of people who have convictions that I don't know about may be righter than I am. I don't know. I know right from wrong. And I know what's kindness, and I know what's goodness, and I don't want to be a bad person. And I don't know whether that's built in. No, I think the moral lessons were taught by my parents. I remember during the Depression, my father and I were once walking along the street, and there was a man in the old times before there were trucks to collect the garbage, there used to be men with round barrels and long brooms who would sweep the streets. They would wear white uniforms, and they'd have these barrels, and they'd sweep the streets and pile them in and throw the stuff into the white barrels and walk down the street, and that's how the streets would get cleaned. And I was walking with my father down the street one time, and I pointed to this man, and I laughed, and I said, "Look at that funny man. He's sweeping the street." My father stopped me dead in my tracks, and he said, "That man probably has a family, and he's trying to feed them and clothe them, and this is the way he can do that, and that has to be respected. And we don't make fun of people when they're doing their job." Now, I was maybe 6 years old. I get the picture, I get the words, it's all embedded in there. I never forgot that. And I still feel that way. I mean, I have friends who are snobs who, you know, they wouldn't have anything to do with blah, blah, blah because inferior or whatever. No, we are all of us people. And some of us with the least are the best. You know, it hasn't anything to do with what you own or what you have or how much you've amassed. Or, you know, our maybe it's all over the world, but certainly in America, our concept of success is so bizarre. If you've got money, you're terrific. Doesn't matter how you got it. You know, you may be a corporate thief. You might be a street thief. You may be a totally untalented person who somehow through the right promotion made millions of dollars doing what? You could be a sports figure and you're no damn good because you're faking it. You're not really playing by talent. But if you've got money, big shot, terrific. The world wants to know you. No. No. Wrong. This is what counts. What's in here? Anything after that is fake, you know?
You've mentored a lot of people embarking on their careers.
Yeah.
I remember a lot of them were very pretty young ladies. I used to call them Adele's Angels.
Those were my people who worked with me, yeah.
Yeah. Was there something that you saw, were there mistakes or misimpressions or misunderstandings that you found that young people starting out in their lives were somehow uniformly making or would all frequently make? What are some of the assumptions that
Not from the experience of the people who worked directly with me, many of whom didn't like me because I was so rigid in what my expectations were. They came to love me and came to respect what they had learned from me. You know, no, this letter cannot go out. It's got three typos. I'm sorry. All right, so I'll fix it. No, you'll redo the letter. No, this is... You know whose signature goes on the bottom of that letter? Mine. It's going to be perfect.
Gurus can be like that, too. Very exacting.
Well,
tough love.
If your name is going to be on it, you should be proud of it. You know?
And for the guru, the disciple is that letter that goes out to the rest of the world.
Yeah. But... in counseling people, there are corporate executives who have come to me for coaching, either because they needed guidance in their job or they wanted to switch careers or they didn't understand what path they should be following. There was one thing that came up quite often that was very fascinating to me. We know that men and women are different. I don't care how many laws of equality they make. Women should be paid the same for work that they do. They should have equal opportunity, all of that. But we are not the same. We are not the same. Usually, women are not as physically strong as men are. Some women are stronger than some men, but that doesn't mean that as a rule or as a group, women are stronger than men. It's not true. We're shorter. Our hearts are of a different composition. Our brains are different. But in the workplace, the manifestation of femaleness is very interesting to me. Men will come in and they will have problems and they will discuss their problems and they'll say, you know, so this is how this guy behaves toward me, and he's a peer in our company, and we're on a parity level. I don't agree with what he's doing with his department, and so he gets offended when I say something to him about it. So we talk about it. Women will come in and say, I'm having a problem with somebody who is on an equal level with me in the workplace, and I don't know what I'm doing wrong. Me, I did it. And I said, what an arrogance. What do you mean what you did wrong? Maybe the circumstances are wrong. Maybe what you're doing wrong is thinking that you are so powerful that you're the one who's shaping this situation. Well, if you are, it's because you're thinking it wrong. You know, so it's a question of women coming into a situation and saying, what are the facts here? You know, it's not a subjective thing. When a workplace thing goes wrong, there are facts involved. And maybe you're involved with the facts. Maybe you, as a female, are not being sensitive what somebody else is doing and therefore are being either manipulative or pushy or uncooperative, or maybe you're looking at the situation and maybe what you're trying to do is saying, I can do this better than you can do it. And so you're setting up a competition when none really has to exist, when a cooperation has to exist. You have to examine the circumstance. And it has to be a question of reality. Not subjectivity, reality. Now, maybe one of you can help me understand this. Why do we as females think that we're more responsible for something going wrong than men do. But you guys may know, you seem to agree with my assumption about women in the workplace.
When I work with a boss who is a woman, and I work in management consulting as well, it's on the side and part time. So, your observation is correct that there is a difference. But I don't know why it is that way. I mean, yeah. If you read, philosophers who talked about women's subjectivity and how they relate to the other. And how they kind of create consciousness and create subjectivity with another person, and men are more instrumental towards their others, so they're not with the other person, but more acting towards them, and get acted to, and throwing the ball back and forth, uh-huh. as opposed to creating kind of an intersubjective relationship of us.
Yeah.
Well, I think women want to please, and men want to be pleased, or at least that's the way the paradigm has.
You think we're genetically that way? Shaped by society.
Do you remember? I'm sorry to interrupt. Do you remember when you were working at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and you had to get up in front of that irate audience, and some of the things they said to you? They didn't know you from anything, but I remember you describing that situation, the hostility that you were confronting there. And they had this very stereotyped image of you. Right?
Yeah.
Wasn't that reflective of some kind of a bias that we have about women in the workplace? I mean, you were the first woman officer. I think that was working against you.
I think.
In those circumstances.
When I was at CPB, there was a group called the American Council of National Organizations, and it was a collection of close to 100 organizations like the NAACP, the National Organization of Women, the AFL-CIO. It was Organized America was represented in that room. There was a hierarchical group of representatives of these organizations from all over the country who were there to serve in an advisory capacity to the CPB board of directors so that they could keep public broadcasting on the right track for public interest. What happened was that in this group, you had individuals who were suddenly representing not public broadcasting, but their own organizational interests, so that the AFL-CIO kept wanting to have labor programs, the NAACP wanted all the programs to be sure that there were equal number of blacks in the compositions of all the programs that we were doing, and it became a highly personalized group of people. The board of directors was very put out with this, and their action on it was to simply ignore the recommendations made by ACNO to the board. When I went to CPB as their vice president for communication, they did me the favor of assigning me ACNO. I was to be in charge of it and was to monitor them and take care of them, nurture them. And nobody had forewarned me about this adversarial conflict that had occurred. I mean, ACNO was so angry with CPB about being ignored and not treated with the respect that they felt this due them, they were prepared to go up on the hill, talk to everybody in Congress, and get all of CPB's money rescinded. so that CPB would no longer exist. They would have no funds from the government. And ACNO was that powerful because they represented millions of citizens. The AFL alone represented 8 million, I think, at the time. And so when I came in as their liaison to the board of directors, they had already had their little caucus meetings, and they knew what their position was going to be. And this was in a big hotel, and the media were in the back of the room. And they were all gathered there, most of them men, a couple of women, maybe three or four minority representatives. And I'm up on the platform, and I'm talking glowingly about how we're going to work together and what we're going to do and how life is going to be wonderful, and we're going to do projects together. And it's just like an idiot, because nobody had forewarned me. Nobody told me that they were on a collision course. And so a man named Al Zak, who was the top communications guy at the AFL-CIO, a tough, really sturdy man with a cigar in his fingers and glasses down on the end of his nose, had Mike set in the middle of the aisle. There were two aisles, and the mics were set there. He came up to the aisle, and he said to me, "Who do you think you are to come in here with your fancy New York ways and tell us what we're going to do?" I mean, my knees were going like that. I'm holding on to the podium. I had no idea this was coming at me. And the media are sitting back there. And I said, I knew who he was. "Mr. Zak, I'm not sure I understand." He said, "Do you have any idea what's been going on here?" And I said, "No, maybe I haven't been informed. I don't know. Could we take a 5-minute break while I consult with my..." There was one other member of the executive team at CPB there. I said, "Well, I talk with my colleague and find out what's going on here, and I'll be back to you." So I talked to our guy who was our programming director. I said, "Don, what's going on here?" So he gave me a little bit of background. I said, "Didn't you think that you or Henry Loomis, our president, should have informed me that if I'm going to be in charge of this group, that I should know what's been going on, instead of sending me off here, to be eaten by the wolves?" And he laughed. I'm just a woman, you know. So I went back there after I thought for a minute, and I said, "Mr. Zak, may I speak with you in public?" He said, "By all means." I said, "I have not been aware of the fact that there has been such controversy between us, and I think we need to work together. And I want to hear not just from my colleagues what's been going on, I want to hear from you all what's been going on and why there is this kind of controversy between us. And I promise you that I will do everything I can to preserve the relationship between our organizations. And if it's not salvageable, then perhaps we will decide together that it can't work. But we will decide together. Is that okay?" He took his cigar, and he put it in his other hand, and he marched up to me. "I think we can do business together," said Mr. Zak. And I went from that, there was other stuff going on, but I went home, and I called our president, Henry Loomis, and I said, "Henry, you set me up." He said, "What do you mean?" "What do you mean?" I said, "Henry, do you have any idea what took place in that room with the media present?" He said, "What?" I said, "Zak came at me with all guns blazing, and they were ready to, destroy me. But I promised that I would work with them." He said, "So what are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to work with them. And if it can't work, then we'll dissolve it. But we'll dissolve it together." He said, "That's why we hired you."
That, by the way, this Henry Loomis was the president of CBS.
CPB.
Of CPB, very powerful man. So what was the takeaway from that for you? That sometimes you're thrown off the deep end of the pier, and you better be ready to swim or sink. Is that the message there?
Well, it taught me, first of all, to do my homework on things before I go into meetings. Mm-hmm. But also to not assume that you know exactly what a picture is when you walk into it.
Okay. You know? All right. You know, there's a part of me that's holding in reserve because I feel a certain responsibility to be connecting this with the topic of our
weekly
gatherings.
Yes.
And what occurs to me is that same kind of, I see you, Michael, hold on. That same kind of preparedness when you go into your yoga practice or your bhakti practice or whatever it is, you better know what that practice is all about, or you're going to be doing yourself a disservice and others a disservice. You have to know what you're getting yourself into, and to naively waltz into a situation assuming that you understand what's going on without doing the background research is setting yourself up potentially for something dangerous.
Yeah, it's a naive approach.
At least a disappointment. Right? And that's something more. Yeah. Michael, you were first.
I have a question that's kind of a practical question. As raising Yogeshwar as a first generation devotee, we get glimpses from what it was like for him to go through the transitions he went through. But I'm curious for what you witness as his transformation and the advice that you can give to people on our podcast of what you can advise young people or middle-aged people going through the transformation of becoming a devotee, as how to interact with their parents, what's practical, and vice versa, what suggestions you can give to the people that are coming Krishna conscious to their parents, and maybe how their parents can also help their day to it since you went through.
That's a good question. Michael's not the only one, by the way, to be asking questions like that. People are very smart here. You know, they want to know, what am I setting myself up for? You know, am I going to be confronting a Zach-like situation that I'm not prepared for?
Because of where I sit and because of a lot of observation in my lifetime, I don't know if young people can get through to their parents. It's supposed to be the parents' responsibility to understand the child. But in this country, which, I mean, fluctuating values, I have no idea what the paternal, maternal roles are, because parents want to be friends with their kids, or they become the kids themselves. And I hate to be denigrating parents, because there are some good ones out there, I think. I think that as a young person, you have to follow your course and be as benign as you can possibly be with your parents and understand that they may not understand what you're all about or what you're doing. But you have to follow your own course. If you have the kind of parents who will listen to you, you can try to explain. But you'll know when you're hitting a wall, when you are getting resistance, and don't even try to break through. It took me 2 years to realize that he had to lead his own life, you know, that I had to let go. You live. That's all you can do, is just live and learn as much as you can while you're living. Yeah.
Can I add one thing? Because your question has another part to it, which is, what did I do that may have impeded reconciling, you know, with family and friends? And I think what I did was to be very self-righteous. about what I had found. The idea that now I am a spiritual person, now I'm a devotee of Krishna, which means what? I don't have to be concerned any longer about that material self. I don't have that family anymore. I don't have all of these other concerns or responsibilities because now I'm living a spiritual life, was not philosophy. It was psychology. It was something that had been unresolved for a long time in me that did not like the life I had come from. Now this, what my mom's describing here, she's being very polite about it. We had some tough times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember a lot of potato dinners when I was a kid. We didn't have any money. It was like, And you had to work, so I was staying with somebody else's family, you know, for time, days on end. And so through nothing other than the circumstances of the life that we've shared, I was contending with, you know, gee, there are other kids who have, you know. And the downside of what she bequeathed to me, which was a good education, was being in schools where the other kids were pretty rich. So intellectually it was very good. Socially it was a total bomb. Because I could not live the life that those other kids were living up at Fieldston in the Bronx with, you know, parents who were heads of corporations or whatever. So that was the downside. So meeting devotees, meeting Krishna consciousness, was this sense of, you know, snap. I don't have to be dealing with all of those disappointments. Now I've got something else. And it took me a long time to realize that I was in the right place, but for the wrong reasons. And that I had to become a little bit more responsible and do the work, the hard work, of becoming a real yogi, if you will, a real bhakti yogi. And that is to go back into the circumstances of this life and find Krishna there. I'm using terminology I think that, you know, most of you can appreciate. And it was at that point that I began to realize, oh my gosh, what a gift this person is in my life. You know, what an amazing path she's created for me by encouraging me, by empowering me to follow what I thought was the right thing for me to do. And, you know, for not berating me for not looking particularly stylish on occasion, you know, or whatever it might have been. That it coming to that point of recognizing that this is also a God-given situation. This is not just chance. This is something really quite beautiful. That was part of my need to mature. So it wasn't all on her shoulder.
Can I ask a follow-up question? So your son, pretty much within the Krishna conscious movement, ran with the who's who of our tradition. Like anybody in our lineage, if you think of that, like the greatest.
It makes it sound so good, doesn't
he? He was friends with them. He knew them. He lived with them. He traveled with them. Were there any devotees that you interacted with through your son that you got any inspiration from or have any good stories that you can share with us?
I enjoyed his friends. I never got to know them too well because we didn't have that much time together. But I liked them. You know, to speak colloquially, they were decent folk, you know. They were nice to know. I liked that they weren't rude. I liked that they were intelligent, that they were thoughtful, that they weren't druggies and promiscuous and all of that stuff. You know, I liked that. And I came to know some of them a little bit better, Phil. Yeah, you know, I never got to know them well. I got to know him well. Yes.
Yeah. With all your experience in life, and when you grew up, when you think of today's generation, how they exploited the girls and the women, you know, like magazines, movies, and everything, what did you do?
Oh, God. what's going on now. I really don't. I think I don't know whether it comes from a sense of entitlement or rebellion that's not a real rebellion, but I don't think that people, and I'm talking about people of all ages, you know, from very little up to maybe 60s, there's no self-respect. Because if you don't respect yourself, you don't respect others. And I think a lot of what's going on is a display of lack of respect. This is a very phony example, but when we used to go to the opera or the theater, we used to dress up, not only because it was a terrific occasion, but it was out of respect for the performers. And now people come in their little, you know, their scuffed shoes and their, you know, their short shorts and their t-shirts and their, you know, and they're playing their text things while the performance is going on. You say, well, why are you here? Why do you even bother? So I don't understand that. But on the other hand, there is another part of society which is in rebellion, and they're the ones who are for the ecology. They're looking at food differently. They're looking at interactions between people differently. There is a segment of society, I'm thinking of Kara, who are reviewing the world in a broader way than I ever did as a kid, because they're exposed to much more, and they mean well, and they will change the world. They will change the world. I hope they're not too outnumbered.
That sort of leads up, I was really curious to ask you about any public figures, you know, contemporary or historical, that inspired you, maybe especially when you were...
Nelson Mandela. Yeah, I thought he was terrific. And interestingly, in his last years, somebody said, do you have any regrets? And he said, I'm sorry I didn't spend more time with my wife and children. So, you know, you've got to calculate what's really important. You know, with all the quarrels that we have with our family and everything, in the long run, they're the ones who are going to be at our graveside. You know, it's not going to be our clients, and it's not going to be our bosses, and it's not going to be, you know, all the people who sat in the audience and clapped and then went out. You know, it's the near and dear, the people you invest heavily in, who invest heavily in you, I think. I don't know everything, but that's what I think.
We're going to wrap up here, so I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Before I come to Tuesday Sunset Gita gatherings, I call my mother.
Aww.
And I say, what do you think I should talk about tonight? And we have these really juicy discussions about things in the news or in the arts or whatever. So a lot of the stuff that you people are all going, whoa, Yogeshwara, wow, did you hear what he said? She gets the credit. So would you please join me in thanking
you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. And I hope to see you next week for our tribute to George Harrison.
Are we in the big room next week?
Yeah, we'll be in the big room. So thank you all very much for being with us.
Will you volunteer next week?
Yeah, a couple of hands would always be helpful.
So everybody can come at like 7:45. It's a mad dash to set up. It's really stressful, but it's rewarding and kind of...